Hello, my name is Phil Lawler. I'm Senior Fellow at the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture at Thomas More College, and I welcome you to my Book of the Month Club. Every month, I arrange to have a conversation with the author of a recently published book that I've found particularly interesting, something that offers a provocative perspective on one or more of the topics that are of particular interest to our center. Those topics are education in the liberal arts, the defense and promotion of marriage and family life, active Christian involvement in civic life, the arts, and the teachings of the Catholic Church. I hope these podcasts will stimulate further conversations as well as interest in our center. If you enjoy what you hear today, please check back to the website of the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture and take a look at some of our other conversations in this Book of the Month series, as well as other offerings from our center. Please also sign up for regular email notices about coming events, both online presentations and live events. Finally, if you're able, please support our work by making a contribution to the work of the center. You'll find a handy form on our website as well. All contributions are appreciated and all are tax deductible. Now on to this month's conversation. My guest today is Stella Morabito, who studied Russian and Soviet history and was for a decade an analyst with the CIA, focused primarily on Soviet propaganda. And that study led her to examine the way the enemies of freedom use propaganda, manipulate the way people think in order to pursue their ends. That in turn led to the publication of her new book, The Weaponization of Loneliness, the subhead, How Tyrants Stoke Our Fear of Isolation to Silence, Divide, and Conquer. Stella Morabito, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to begin the conversation in an odd way, sort of at the end of the book. Your final chapter, your conclusion, begins with the quotation that I'll just read. When asked how he went bankrupt, a character in an Ernest Hemingway novel memorably answered, "Two ways, gradually and then suddenly." That struck me because I am, I think, more than usually interested in politics and more than usually attuned to a loss of freedom. Yet I am still reeling from the abrupt loss of freedom that we experienced a couple of years ago, when suddenly we were being told we couldn't go outside, there were things we had to wear, we had to take a vaccine, we couldn't have meetings. Just an astonishing acceleration of government control over our lives, and we accepted it. I wonder if I'd read your book a few years ago, whether I would have been so surprised. Were you surprised?
Oh, by the level of compliance with all of those COVID mandates. In one way, I was surprised. In another way, I wasn't, because I feel as though we had been conditioned over years of, not just loss of freedom, but, you know, I go into this in earlier chapters in my book. Self-censorship, political correctness, identity politics, and what's enforced by the mob mindset or the mob agitation. We had been conditioned through all of those mechanisms, I call it the machinery of loneliness, to accept and comply with a lot of things that our better judgment would not have allowed if we exercised better judgment. So, you know, suddenly after, you know, gradually, I mean, it had the gradual buildup to these losses of freedom came after generations, really, or decades of obedience to political correctness. So by the time COVID hit, we were already, so many of us were already conditioned, you know, through all of the institutions that had already been subverted to a huge degree, especially education. At the same time, it kind of blew me over how much compliance there was. And you know, people who I had thought would know better would be able to pick up on, especially after a few weeks of this. You know, at first, I think most of us were a little concerned about, you know, how real this virus was and everything. Sure. And so it didn't take long, you know, after the so-called 15 days or whatever it was to, quote, flatten the curve, you know, turning into years, you know, it should have occurred to a lot more of us that, that there was something more going on. And all of these efforts to literally isolate us after so many decades of being conditioned into a kind of state of mental isolation. And what I mean by that is the self-censorship that so many people practiced as a result of political correctness, which of course goes to my thesis about how, you know, our fear of ostracism is very, very natural in human beings. And so that can easily be manipulated to induce self-censorship. And I believe it has been.
Yes. And you explain in some detail, particularly with reference to the educational establishment, how self-censorship has grown and how that has been used as a means of leapfrogging into the political correctness movement, the woke movement.
Yeah, it's kind of beyond all of our expectations from maybe 10 years ago. I mean, you know, so many things have happened. I compare it often to a game of whack-a-mole. All of these strange agendas seem to have cropped up all at once, you know, the challenges to due process in law, the campus mantra that free speech is hate speech or speech is violence, the transgender insanity, the trillions and trillions in debt. I mean, it goes on and on and on. So you would think that we would have known better by the time, you know, by the time it became sudden or it seemed sudden, but the groundwork had been laid for generations, for decades.
It had. And you make a point that the drive toward loneliness is not incompatible with, in fact, it feeds the instinct of the mob, that these are very closely related phenomena.
Oh, yes. Yeah. No, a sense of being isolated is very conducive to people joining mobs or gangs or cults. That's all pretty well established. And in fact, cults will often recruit from those they believe are, you know, lonely. And then they'll, quote, love bomb them and so on and so forth. You know, I can go off on a tangent there. But the central point in totalitarianism or, you know, the loss of freedom or the attacks on freedom, the central means of doing that is through isolation. And in an early chapter, I have an epigraph from Hannah Arendt, who wrote that epic book about the origins of totalitarianism in the early 1950s, where she states that, you know, terror can't rule over people unless they're isolated against one another. And so the primary goal of all tyrannical government is to bring that isolation about. You know, obviously, if we all have strong families and joyful friendships and, you know, strong faith communities, and, you know, all of those things are a source of strength, not just to the individual, but to their communities. And tyranny just can't get rooted in that kind of an environment where we have strong relationships with one another that are healthy and functional. And so, as we've seen throughout history, Arendt was correct about that.
Yes.
Cultivating a sense of loneliness is how you can more easily condition people into accepting a loss of freedom. It's like, it's the way Stockholm Syndrome works, you know? Stockholm Syndrome, the captive bonds with a captor because they've been isolated and made to be dependent upon that one source, the captor of their connection.
There's, yeah, you're triggering all sorts of thoughts here for me. Your book could be disheartening in a lot of ways. Then at the end, you make a lot of very practical suggestions about how to recover from this loneliness, how to jump off this locomotive. And you reminded me in what you were just saying that the family is the first society in which we're grown. The family is always the ultimate minority group, isn't it? Because there's just your family. Mm-hmm. And it's your family against the world, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And strong families are a key to strong societies. And part of the drive to loneliness is a drive against families, or a drive to it takes a village mentality.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and it takes families to build those villages, not the other way around, as you and I both know. Functioning families are so important to a healthy civil society. And there's so much brokenness now, and a lot of these crazy policies have led directly to family breakdown. I mean, it goes way back, this attack on the family. I mean, in modern history, you can trace the blatant attack on the family to the publication of the Communist Manifesto in 1848, in which one of the blunt lines is "abolish the family!" exclamation mark. So, you know, it's very clear that the family, religion, you know, really strong traditions that are healthy and allow for a functioning society in religion, the family, community, real friendship, all of that is anathema to totalitarianism and tyranny. So exactly, you're exactly right. The family is the microcosm of a healthy society. And of course, we could go on another tangent and talk about the importance of the mother-child bond and what's been done to destroy that in modern society, and how the mother-child bond is so important to the functioning of families. The mother-child bond, particularly when connected with a father.
Right.
The father, and that unit is extremely powerful. And you mentioned, of course, that at the end of my book, I end on a message of hope, because I personally believe that pessimism in itself is lethal to a civil society. If you have mass pessimism, and that's very destructive, because demoralization is the first phase of total subversion. And so that's something that we have to avoid. We have to learn to be of good cheer and be not afraid, and learn to speak up about these things and reach out and help to rebuild the broken bonds in society.
Absolutely.
And that's not really as hard as we think it is. It gets harder and harder because the impulse to avoid rejection is so strong.
It is, but yes, but well, let me make two points there. First, I made a quixotic political campaign 23 years ago. I knew I wasn't going to win, but I wanted to give people a choice. And when I spoke to audiences, and of course, like any campaigning politician, I sought out audiences where I thought they would like me. But the most common response I got was, "That was so great to hear somebody say things that I believed and I hadn't heard. I didn't know you could say these things."
Wow.
And to use the sort of pop psychology jargon, I was giving people permission to say things that mm-hmm. they believed.
Right.
I wasn't convincing them. But the other thing that I want to say that I think is very important is the way of life that we try to live with strong families and strong communities and strong faith is attractive. We have a product that sells. People mm-hmm. want to be like that. And mm-hmm. I think sometimes we're tricked by the mass media into thinking that it's not attractive and hiding our lights beneath a bushel, because it's mm-hmm. what most people want.
Oh, yeah. No, the seduction of shiny objects, you know, all the shiny objects that celebrities hold out, and, you know, just the popular culture pushes. I'm not so sure it's working the way it used to work. It's become just so unattractive. I mean, I didn't watch the Grammys. I don't. But if you see how debauched everything was, it just not attractive. The shiny objects seem to have lost a lot of their gloss for a lot of people, I believe. And you're exactly right. What people are really craving when they go after those shiny objects are exactly what you're saying. Strong family, strong bonds, strong relationships, friendship, real friendship, where you can let your hair down and basically, quote, have permission to think out loud things that you didn't think you had permission to say because political correctness had taken such a hold over everybody and everything. And, you know, what you had said before, I think, was just so interesting. You know, people, while you're on the campaign trail, people saying, gee, you know, you're saying things I always thought that way. This is so interesting because I've had people and I've talked to other people have gone through the same thing where you have this kind of whispering that comes up to you afterwards. Oh, yeah. Yes. I agree with you, but they're so afraid to say it out loud. And that's what I think is really lethal to civil society. When you hide what you think, when you can't feel free to express your thoughts to other people, you can't really develop relationships. I mean, you can't really develop a civil society. If everybody is doing that, you're destroying potential, you're losing knowledge, along with potential and relationships, and you're losing freedom.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, because when we shut up about what we believe out of that fear of ostracism, or even lie about what we believe in order to feel like we're being accepted, we don't understand the extent to which we are actually shaping what's called public opinion. We create what's called a spiral of silence about what we believe that creates the illusion that what we believe is a minority fringy viewpoint when it's not at all, when it's actually a majority viewpoint. And this is really dangerous. But it's also the way these social engineers have operated to create these public opinion cascades.
Yes. And we won't do justice to your book in just a few minutes of discussion, but you do a terrific job of analyzing how this is coming at us from all sorts of different directions, as you said earlier, the whack-a-mole effect. Mm-hmm. I think the positive thing that is coming out of this conversation for me is you're helping me to reaffirm my belief that the pendulum is likely, or at least could swing in the other direction, because we've gone so far. And mm-hmm. The difference between what people believe in their heart of hearts and what they are encouraged to profess is so great. I had a friend stop me the other day and ask me, which group of people I think is more detached from reality, the people you see on Oscars night or the people you see at the State of the Union address? And that bespeaks a level of alienation from the prevailing atmosphere that at least gives us an opportunity to get our act together.
Oh, yes. No, people are craving real connection, real knowledge, real conversation. You can see this. There was a piece I read a few years ago about how so many young men were watching Jordan Peterson's talks, and they were finally being able to, you know, have real information, real conversations about things that mattered, or to hear someone talking about things that they'd always wondered about, you know, whether it was religion or philosophy or, you know, all these things that are now destroyed along with departments of humanities and all the universities. And so that pointed to, I think in the article, they talked about these parallel polices that are being created everywhere.
Well, yes. Look at the explosion in homeschooling.
Oh, yes.
And I'm now affiliated with Thomas More College and the very small Catholic liberal arts college. Like all other small Christian liberal arts colleges, is enjoying an explosion in applications. Mm-hmm. There is a counterculture developing. Whether it's developing fast enough is the only question.
Yeah. But I, you know, I think that just talking one-on-one to people about what you believe, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, a huge megaphone. One of the epigraphs I use for the last chapter comes from Jacques Ellul's book. He was the eminent sociologist, 20th century, who wrote the epic book on propaganda. The Formation of Men's Attitudes is the subtitle. And the most pithy and amazing to me sentence in the book is, propaganda ends where simple dialogue begins.
Right.
And it's really about our one-on-one conversations, our one-on-one relationships with people who implicitly trust us, whether they know what we believe or not, you know, a neighbor, somebody that you see in daily life every day, that you smile at the store or whatever, real people with real lives who care about real things, but are maybe fearful of expressing these things. I mean, that's where our influence is. It's really in reaching out and getting our toe in the water and being able to kind of lead the way in creating a ripple effect, the ripple effect that Václav Havel talks about in his essay, 1978, The Power of the Powerless. That's where the hidden sphere of life, just these one-on-one conversations and these mediating institutions of family, faith, and friendship is what ripples outward. And it's very powerful. It's if you look at all the really supposedly powerful institutions that are all corrupt now, like the big media, big tech, and everything, one-on-one conversations are really the sieve through which this asymmetric warfare, or whatever you want to call it, can be conducted to turn things around. And, you know, we should use whatever freedom we have left to push that forward. And I really believe we can.
Well, I think that's a great place to wrap up our conversation. And it's right about on time. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you, Phil.
Thank you for joining us for this podcast. This is Phil Lawler speaking for the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture at Thomas More College. I hope you've enjoyed this presentation, and I hope you'll register on our website to receive information about future events hosted by the center. If you find these recordings helpful, please help us to continue our work by making a tax-deductible contribution. We cannot continue to provide fine programming without the support of people like you, and we're grateful for your help. To receive updates on our activities or to make a contribution to our work, see our webpage at restorationchristianculture.org. That's all lowercase with no spaces or punctuation, restorationchristianculture.org. Thank you again.